It is 8:08 in the Twin Cities. Time now for one of my absolute favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and I have to start off by mentioning one thing, that I sent you a picture through your phone this week proving that I can actually grow a Trump chia pet.
And for those, this has been an ongoing theme here. If you didn't hear some of our prior discussions, I often call you for help with stories, to get your expertise on politics, but also legal issues. And I ventured over to your office at Hamline, and there was a large bucket with full of water, several, maybe 3 or 4 gallons of water and 2 blobs in it. And I was just going, what are you doing? And you were trying to grow your chia pet hair.
Right.
Or soaking it, or I don't know what you were doing.
Well,
still,
you're supposed to pre-soak the chia heads before you actually put the seeds on them. And I have Obama and Trump chia heads. And I explained to you that the first time I did it, we couldn't get any hair, growth on the 2 skulls, 2 heads.
And as we have talked about before, you are actually a gifted and talented gardener. So, but you somehow can't grow a chia pet.
Right, but
now we're past that.
We have passed it, but I have to still give credit again. I have an administrative assistant who helped me on it. So, Miriam, if you're listening tonight, you get all the credit for it. And so she bailed me out.
All right. Yay, Miriam. All right. Well, listen, we're so glad. And it's you're kind of headed to the comb over.
Yes.
With the Donald one, which is great.
We have enough. I sent you a picture on your cell phone. And right now, they both, Trump and Obama, both look like they stuck their fingers in an electric socket, like that. But the Trump hair is, you know what I mean by hair, but you know, the herb is long enough at this point that I can actually do a comb over. So next week, when I go into my office on Monday, I'm going to do that. So what I'll eventually do is post this on like my Facebook page or something like that, or on my blog or something like that, so people can see the comb over Trump.
All right. Well, and as I'm going to try and find this on my phone here as we are speaking right now, because it is pretty funny stuff.
If you want to post it on your Facebook or your website, wherever, go ahead and do that too.
I've got your permission to post your chia pets.
You do.
All right. Well, this is a momentous day of sorts. This is actually the 100th day of the Trump administration. And it's interesting because I think this president really talked about what he was going to do on the campaign trail during his first. Well, he talked about actually what he was going to do the first day.
Right.
But he really talked about how much he was going to get done in the early days of his administration. And is that something, I mean, did he do that more than most candidates, or is that something that all candidates do?
All candidates do in a variety of ways. Lay out obviously their entire agenda in terms of what they want to accomplish, and lots of them will describe what they hope to achieve in those first 100 days. I do think Donald Trump had a longer wish list than I think many presidents have had, because I think a lot of people going into office who have had either military or prior government experience temper what they say they can get done, understanding the complexities of moving legislation through Congress and so forth. And I think part of why Trump embellished so much spoke to the fact that he didn't have that prior experience in the military or in the government. And as he's recently confessed, when he said, this is a lot harder than I thought, I think he thought it was going to be a lot easier to move a lot of his promises than it turned out to be. So I think that's one issue. The second is that I think we're really seeing the education of Donald Trump realizing that some things that he promised might not have been very good ideas.
Well, I do think the comment, I thought it would be easier.
Right.
Was stunning to me, because I think no matter what, I don't think anyone thinks being president is easy.
No, I was going to say is that I think almost everybody recognizes the fact that this might very well be the hardest job in the world. We often describe it also as maybe the most powerful person in the world. But there are also things that presidents just can't do. At the end of the day, Richard Neustadt arguably wrote the greatest book ever on the presidency called Presidential Power, and said the essence of presidential power is the power to persuade, is that you just can't order people around like kings or generals, or in this case, CEOs. You actually have to persuade people. You've got to worry about things like checks and balances, separation of powers, and all that places significant limits on what presidents can actually do.
And clearly, but you know, I thought that was just so. Yes. That was a remarkable interview that he did with Reuters, because he actually seemed almost wistful.
Yes.
About saying, I loved my past life. Mm-hmm. I had so much going on. And then he kind of went on to talk about the freedoms that he had.
Right. And what was interesting about that interview, it reminded me also of presidents when they get to like year number 8. And I say that because I remember George Bush in his last year was at that point of saying yes. He kind of wanted to get back to his private life. You know, he wanted to escape the presidency. Obama was sort of that in his last year. But I've seen a couple of post-presidency interviews of George Bush over the years, and he seemed perfectly delighted to be able to escape sort of public scrutiny, public eye. You know, he's become I'm not sure if I would call him a great painter, but he's an enthusiastic painter, at least. But the point is that usually presidents get to their 8th year and they're kind of exhausted. Like, wow, I almost got this sense that Trump, after, 90-some days, was where other presidents are after 8 years.
Right. I mean, definitely. I mean, it almost made you wonder, if this is where he is after 100 days, where is he going to be 2 years from now?
Oh, I know.
And he's not young either.
That's right. Was he 72? 72?
Isn't he the oldest first-time elected president?
I think he is, because he's over 70, correct?
Yes, but I think he was actually older.
Yes.
than Ronald Reagan was when he was first elected, not by a lot, but you know.
Right.
So I think that's something.
You're correct. He's older, and I'm not saying anything disparaging when I say this about him. Also, remember, was it last year? You know, I think on the medical exam or some medical information released pointed out that he is overweight, and I think he has some blood pressure problems, if I remember correctly. You know, so he's not a picture of perfect health either, on top of his age. And I just say that because, you know, I'm not demeaning people, you know, who are in their 70s, but he's in a very stressful job, older than anybody else who's been in that job, and not in the best of health.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, we do have to take a quick break here. When we come back, let's talk more about the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Esme Murphy, along with David Schultz, talking about the first 100 days of the Trump administration. So what has he gotten done?
I'd say his two biggest accomplishments is getting a Supreme Court nomination through Neil Gorsuch and canceling of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think those are the two, if he can sort of look at his bucket list in terms of what he wanted to check off, he has those. Beyond that, he doesn't have any major legislative victories whatsoever. He hasn't been able to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He hasn't moved on taxes, which he said he was going to do right away. And if we also look at his executive orders, he has had three executive orders now shot down by the federal courts dealing with immigration, and it's not clear if any of his other executive orders are really going to make much of a difference in terms of going forward. So right now, I'd have to say not a lot of accomplishments in terms of what he can look at.
And in terms of the health care bill, the thing he said he was going to do first, mm-hmm. it looks like he's lost again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does not look like this is far. And I think he actually alluded to that as well when he said, I think early on, this healthcare thing is really complicated.
Right,
which of course it is.
It is very complicated. You know, when you were trying to reform essentially 1/6 of the U.S. economy, it becomes very, very complicated. And there was an effort to try to do it again this week, in terms of bringing it up for a vote again. And he couldn't get agreement either within the Republican Party, and then the Democrats said that they would not vote on a stopgap measure to keep the government funded if there was a vote scheduled on the health care bill. So that's off again. That's off again at this point. Whether or not it comes back, we don't know. But he was unsuccessful there. And then let's sort of take some other positions that he took during the campaign that he's changed on. You know, during the campaign, he said that things such as Syria were none of our business, and suddenly, you know he's gotten us involved potentially in Syria with the airstrikes. He thought that, or he was going to say he was going to build the wall. The wall doesn't look like that's going to happen, and we don't have the funding for it. He said that he was going to label China as a currency manipulator, and at the same time was going to impose tariffs on them. Hasn't done that. Thought NATO wasn't important. Now NATO is. And so in so many things, we could sort of run off a checklist here on a lot of the positions that he took while running for president of the United States. He has reversed himself over the last, I would say, the last month or so. There's almost two Trump presidencies now within the first 100 days. You know, there's the Trump presidency, let's say, in the first 30 or so days. And since then, there almost seems to be a second Trump presidency as it's starting to evolve into perhaps a third Trump presidency, going into, you know, the 101st day forward.
All right. And I do want everyone to know, because I'm sure that they have been waiting with bated breath, I have posted your Chia pet picture.
All right.
On my Twitter, if you go to, and it also will end up on my Facebook, at Esme Murphy on either Facebook or Twitter, at Esme Murphy, you'll see it. I give you full credit. And folks, you can see the comb over coming.
Right, right.
So it's really good. They are really funny.
Yeah, right now I would describe the hairdos for both Obama and Trump, especially Trump, as kind of a Richard Simmons look, if you know what I mean.
Well, the potential is there for the comb over. That's what I like about it so much.
It is. And so this is the project on Monday.
All right, absolutely. All right, and we'll keep updating these photos as we get them. In terms of where he goes from here, I mean, the healthcare situation, it's like they want to keep the best parts. It just looks like what they want to keep is really the essence of it.
Right.
But then they're trying to roll it back. I don't see how they're going to do this. I really don't.
They don't. I think if one of the there's a couple of things here. One is it's getting the political consensus to do that in terms of keeping the good parts versus scrapping what they think is the bad parts. And they're not going to get cooperation with the Democrats, we know on that. The question is, can they sort of corral together really a very divided Republican Party, some who want to just completely replace the Affordable Care Act and not replace with anything, and some who want to make some variations of changes. And so they've got a political issue that's out there, especially at a time where now, for the first time in the last couple of months now, first time since the Affordable Care Act was passed, that a majority of the American public actually supports it, you know, and so that creates a problem. I think the second issue is that if one of the criticisms, I think she's a valid one, of the original Affordable Care Act was some of its actuarial soundness. And what I mean by that, in order for insurance to work, you have to get enough people who are healthy, who are paying into the system, to be able to pay for those people who are sick. I mean, that's the basic principle of insurance, the socialization of risk. And I mention that because there were some concerns about the idea of saying that the Affordable Care Act wasn't financially actuarially sound. Well, which is why you had the mandate buy insurance to try to force healthy people to buy insurance. Well, it's going to be hard to say that we're going to still require insurance companies to cover pre-existing illnesses, cover children, and so forth, and do it in a way that will be affordable. If you don't require people to buy insurance. And so I think that's going to be a very, very difficult trick to deal with, because as we talked about on this show, you know, during last fall, when Governor Dayton pointed out that the Affordable Care Act was unaffordable for many people, it was true. There's an affordability
issue.
And it still is. And there's no indications that the fixes that were being talked about by Trump and the Republicans were going to fix that affordability issue whatsoever. And so they're kind of stuck in terms of what do you really do, because you can't keep those nice provisions, we want to call it the popular ones, jettison everything else, and at the same time solve the affordability problem.
Obviously, a very difficult situation as well. One of the things, obviously, Trump has sort of continued to maintain his style. The brashness is there. The tweets are there. And that has worked for him. The question is, how does that translate when he starts tweeting about North Korea? And it's just, I think this has a lot of people nervous.
Well, it does. Before I even get to North Korea, let me point out how his tweeting and use of social media and speeches have been used against him. You know, when he, you know, I mentioned at the top of the hour that he's now had three different executive orders, two with the Muslim ban, one with sanctuary cities, essentially halted by the courts. And when the Trump administration has gone to court and said, well, these are not Muslim bans, we're not trying to target people, what have the courts done? They have introduced his speeches and his tweets to say, well, look, this is exactly what you are saying in all these pronouncements here, and they're using that language against him. And so that is a problem for him, that he may be making the presidency more accessible by using the social media, but that very language is now hurting him. And it's going to do the same thing with North Korea, because he's been doing sort of foreign policy by Twitter, and that has really sort of escalated the tensions, with North Korea, and it's probably why you have people like State Department, place people like secretaries of state and institutions like State Departments to handle stuff like this, because you really want to make sure that the things that you are saying are vetted properly, because so much of international politics is about the language and discourse that you use.
And in terms of North Korea, though, is it especially tricky here with you've got somebody who's by all accounts really not sound,
right.
of mind?
No, you're right. I mean, we're looking at a country
that... and you know, the president also seemed to suggest, you know, had some sympathetic things to say about how difficult it must be to be Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were kind of trying to wrap their head around that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we have a regime that is so isolated that it doesn't really have to adhere to traditional international norms in terms of rules of diplomacy and etiquette. We know that it's a country, you know, that either has or is trying to acquire nuclear capabilities to fire missiles at the United States. I just mention this because it's an unpredictable regime in many ways, and the comments that Trump makes are just provoking a regime that is already paranoid about the United States, already one that is outside the mainstream of the rest of the world. And so these kind of comments certainly don't help. Having said that, there was a great piece that was in the New York Times, or the Washington Post, might have been the Washington Post, about a week ago that said what Trump has on his hands is a slow-ticking Cuban Missile Crisis. And I think that's a really interesting observation, because at some point North Korea is going to get the capability of launching a missile, not just, let's say, Hawaii or Guam, but mainland United States. And the question is, how does the United States plan on addressing that? And there doesn't seem to be either a viable military or short-term viable diplomatic solution for addressing that issue.
It does seem as if the president has come to the understanding that he cannot just have an isolationist foreign policy.
Exactly.
Which is essentially what he said he would do.
That's right. To be America's first actually require, or make America great again, or make America first, America first is what he really said in his inauguration, actually requires the United States to have a significant international presence. Since World War II, we have created what's called Pax Americana. We've created a world largely in the image of the United States. We won the Cold War, and it's because the United States has been involved in the rest of the world. And if we retreat from it, it's going to be harder for the United States to be able to maintain that kind of world that Donald Trump really wants to have.
All right, folks. So we are chatting with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. We are going to take a quick break, give you some weather. And when we come back, we'll have more with him. So keep it right here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 8:36 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Along with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, we want to switch gears now. The legislative session, the Minnesota legislature, is going to wrap up, supposedly. 3 weeks from Monday is the deadline.
Correct.
Your thoughts on where they are or where they aren't, it might be a better way to say it.
Okay. Where they are is at this point is just, I think it was on Friday, the Republicans in the House and Senate agreed on what's called the budget targets. And what I mean by the budget targets is, you know, the Minnesota budget is actually 10 different bills, omnibus bills, each dealing with different areas like public safety and security or transportation. House and Senate have agreed on how much money they want to spend in each area. Now they get the Senate back to the different chambers and conference committees to hammer it out, except there's a problem here. The problem is they don't have agreement with the governor. And the governor's priorities in terms of spending versus what the Republicans want to do is far apart, upon which, also of which, the Republicans have lots of policy thrown into the budget bills. The upshot is that while it looks like they're getting close, they are a long way off with possible vetoes from the governor, and we're back to a situation where it seems to be the new normal in Minnesota now where we probably, barring something completely surprising, are going to go into what? Special session again 3 weeks from now in terms of hammering out the budget bills. And so I think we are a long ways away because there isn't that agreement between the governor and the Republicans on a whole host of things.
Well, and the problem, it seems to me, is that Republicans, and I know that Speaker Kurt Dowd feels this way because I've asked him, they feel they have a mandate.
Yes.
They feel they have a mandate with what happened in the November elections by controlling now the House and the Senate.
Right.
I also think Governor Dayton feels that he has a legacy to protect, and mm-hmm. he is the governor, and it is his obligation to act as a roadblock to these plans.
Exactly.
I mean, I think he feels very passionately about it, and you've got the other side that feels very passionately about it, and so you have this what appears to be at loggerheads. I mean, the proposals on the budget aren't even anywhere close. I mean, they're completely off in terms of tax cuts and cuts to health and human services.
Mass transportation.
It's not even anywhere in the ballpark, and you've got 3 weeks. Now, you do have a little wiggle room, I guess, because you've got, you know, the session ends May 22nd, which is 3 weeks from Monday. And then you've got, what, 6 weeks before July 1st?
Right.
And if it's not done by July 1st, then you do have a shutdown.
Sure, have a shutdown. But you're right. So technically we've got this six-week wiggle room, but go talk to, for example, any school district in the state of Minnesota where they're looking at their new budget year starting on July 1st also. They need to know in advance of July 1st how much money they're going to have so they know, for example, how many teachers to hire. They need to know it for a variety of purposes. Local government's in the same situation, too. So, yes, you can push it closer to July 1st, but the more you push it to that, you make it much more difficult to plan. And for any parent out there, you know, who's thinking about saying, well, gosh, you know, I'm making some decisions where I'm going to send my child to school next year or particular school districts face this quandary about budgeting and planning. But yes, we, you know, go back, I'd say almost now 20 years, you know, the norm now seems to be, except in years where we have Democrats having controlled everything, like a few years ago, Dayton in the House and the Senate, is that we're going to special session all the time, and we've had two government shutdowns and a near government shutdown. And I know early in January when we were doing this show at one point, we sort of speculated, and I said, I don't think it's too premature to talk about special session, not too premature to think about that we could be running into a potential governmental or partial governmental shutdown again. And I still think that's a possibility.
Right. And the last one was in 2011. It was 20 days.
Right.
And let me ask you, because I was doing some research on this. I mean, why aren't other states having this problem? Why is it always us? And then in 2005, I think there was a five-day shutdown.
Right. And then in 99 or 2000, it was like a one-day shutdown or an almost shutdown because Ventura was governor. Roger Moe was the Senate majority leader. And I can't remember who was in the House was Republicans. And I think they missed it by one day, but I think what they did is like a one day or 1 or 2 days they missed it by, but they did like a temporary stopgap measure to sort of say we're going to keep funding things. So we've had two or three now. Why other states don't do it? You know, partly it's the fact that there's two reasons. One, we're such a polarized country now that in many states, we either have single party control with all the players.
So
the two chambers plus the governor, we have something like that going on, or we have situations to where they have a different budget process in place. Now, one of the things that I like to compare us to is the state of Wisconsin. And the state of Wisconsin has a piece of legislation in place that I've been advocating at least for a decade. I was going to say longer. When I used to do like a midnight show on weekends occasionally with on CCO, Brad Walton, you might remember him.
Absolutely, yes.
Wonderful person, unfortunately, who passed away a few years ago. And I talked about how in the state of Wisconsin, what happens if they can't reach their budget, they can't reach agreement on their budget by the end of the fiscal year, there's an automatic continuing resolution that kicks into place that funds the government at the current level or the level of the previous budget process so that the government just can't shut down. And I have advocated for years saying that we ought to have legislation like that that basically says if we can't reach agreement, we continue funding at the level of the previous budget year just to make sure everything continues.
Right. I mean, something clearly needs to be done. Another issue, too, I don't travel a lot, but, you know, I couldn't help but notice last weekend when I did travel, all the signs at the airport saying that you won't be able to use your Minnesota driver's license mm-hmm. to get on a plane starting in January.
Yes.
And, you know, there are an awful lot of people who don't travel very frequently, but do it once or twice a year that don't have passports.
That's right.
And you know, if you're a family, I can, you know, it's expensive to get a passport.
It's very expensive.
And just to get, you know, I mean, it's over $100 a person. I think it's over $100 for a child. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to have people wanting to get passports so they can get on a plane once a year,
right? And one of the things,
they've got to figure that out.
They do. If you think of what should have been the easiest and perhaps one of the most important things the legislature needed to do this year was to basically pass Real ID so that our driver's license would come in conformity with federal law so that it would at that point allow us to be able to use domestically our driver's license for ID purposes. Now, clearly, internationally, you have to use a passport. We know that.
Right.
You know, but I was just using an example here just a few weeks ago. I was in Washington, D.C. I was at the State Department. I made sure I brought my passport because they weren't going to accept my driver's license at the Harry S. Truman State Department building at that point. And I've heard other stories at this point.
Really? So in other words, you're going at a meeting at, you know, obviously a very secure facility,
right,
the State Department. And in order to get in, you had a Minnesota driver's license wasn't good enough.
Wasn't going to cut it, and I knew it wasn't going to cut it. And in fact, I got there with the passport, and I was actually talking to the security guard person there, and he said, "Yeah, they're already for a lot of government buildings and installations not letting people in from Minnesota." And I've heard a few people say that one of the places where they're having difficulty getting in already with just a Minnesota's driver's license are military bases.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's one of the ones with additional security. Anyway, I do. And I guess the hang-up is that the governor wanted to attach it to allow driver's licenses for undocumented workers.
Correct.
Which is obviously a very thorny thing. I will say it's interesting that there are some Republicans who represent areas of Minnesota that do have large numbers of undocumented mm-hmm. workers who actually are in favor of this because they think it's a safety issue.
Yes.
To have somebody go through that rigorous
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
But it is very troubling, and I think people are going to be angry.
Yes, they are. And so that was one that you expected to be a really easy one that should have happened back in January, and I'm still hopeful it's going to happen, but there's not been a lot of action on it in the last few weeks, and I suspect Real ID is becoming a bargaining chip, that the two sides are going to use that as a bargaining chip on something else, and then if let's say the budget collapses on something else, they're going to use the Real ID as the cudgel to attack the other side. So they've politicized that. But yes, that's going to have a big implications if they don't pass that, because Minnesotans are going to have a real major problem getting on airlines and doing just about anything else come January 1st.
All right. Listen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to visit with you on really a series of extraordinary circumstances involving the mayor of Minneapolis in an election year. Mm-hmm. Unusual stuff, to say the least. All right. So keep it here. More with David Schultz after this on News Radio 830. It is 54 degrees in the Twin Cities. I want to get a shout out to the producer of this show, Susan Blanche, and also a big thank you to Kevin Reed and also Jonathan Lowe, our two studio coordinators for this evening. Some final thoughts from Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. This is obviously an election year in Minneapolis and in other communities around the state of Minnesota. The situation in Minneapolis, though, has been a little crazy.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about what is going on with Mayor Hodges? And this time there are not 30 candidates running or 30 plus. There are only 9, I think.
Only 9. First off, she's clearly vulnerable even before the campaign season started. Is that I think she's had a rocky, 3 years as mayor. I think has had testy relationships in terms of dealing with the police chief, and has faced, I think, real difficult problems in terms of crime issues in Minneapolis. But what's happened in the last few weeks, or less, even want to say the last 10 days, has been very odd. And two odd things. One of them, for many people, which came out of the sort of the clear blue sky, is her announcement. I think was it earlier this week or last week? I think earlier this week, that she was a victim of sex abuse when she was younger, and people sort of wondered, well, where's this story coming from? And then yesterday, when Chief Hartow had announced an appointment for the 4th district, the mayor vetoes it, and then now stories are coming out that that she actually had earlier praised or at least acquiesced to the selection.
Yeah, there was these text messages that I guess, the story in the Star Tribune, which certainly raises some questions as well. And nobody certainly wants to minimize at all, somebody being, sexually assaulted.
Exactly.
or victimized. But the timing, I think, had a lot of people sort of wondering, where has this been? And I think what she said is that politics had always kept her from, bringing this out and talking about it openly. And certainly there are many people who are adults who do that, and we don't want to suggest that that's wrong, but I think there are many people
right.
who are wondering why now.
Right.
And then on top of that, there was another issue that happened where this, person who writes columns or whatever came out with a list of the 3 worst mayors.
Exactly.
Well, the worst mayor, according to this individual, was Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York.
Right.
Number 2 was Mayor Bessie Hodges, and number 3 was Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. And it gave, a host of reasons why, and the mayor strongly came out and, criticized this, as obviously she was going to do. One of the things they did talk about was the problems with the construction in downtown Minneapolis, which is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been going on for a very long time.
Nicolette's right in your backyard.
Right. It looks worse now than it did 3 years ago when it started. And I think a lot of people are sort of wondering what's happening. And, they're saying that it will be substantially done by the time of the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
of which, you know, there will be an awful lot of attention focused on Minnesota. But it's going to be – I think she's definitely – I think she needs to do something.
She is. Now, it's important to remember also that the mayor's position in Minneapolis is actually a weaker position than St. Paul. I mean, it's actually called a weak mayor position. But having said that, there's a real set of criticisms out there that Hodges is a particularly weak mayor and is not exercising very good judgment. And just again, this past week, the stories have been very odd about her and her mayorship. And I was actually thinking up until very recently that as the incumbent, she still was the front runner to win re-election. I'm increasingly coming to think at this point that she's going to have a very hard time winning. Now, who's actually going to win, I don't know. But I think she's got a very difficult challenge in terms of winning a second term in Minneapolis, especially when previous mayors seem to get elected to, what, three terms?
Right. Well, and then I think her style, you know, it contrasts sharply with, you know, a mayor that was very, very popular, R.T. Ryback,
right,
who had, you know, who seemed to be everywhere and was extraordinarily accessible,
right,
to the news media. And I think that that's and accessible to other groups. And I think that's something that she hasn't done.
Right, and it's odd given the fact she was on city council for, what, 8 years, I think, or something like that? And one, I can't remember how many years, but you would have thought she would have honed a style that would make her more comfortable in public. And she actually seems very, very uncomfortable in public.
She does, and she can also be extremely funny and charismatic. I've seen those moments from her, and yet it's not there. Let me ask you this, though. You have the ranked choice voting in Minneapolis where you get to choose the first and second choice. Doesn't that help her?
I think potentially it does, because even if she is not the first choice, she still might enjoy name recognition enough among people that they list her as a second choice or say, well, she's the incumbent. And so I think she does benefit from it in terms of ranked choice. Again, whether she plays that strategy well this time, I don't know. I think when she ran the first time, again, she was the front runner after the first vote and was very successful in terms of playing the ranked choice voting in order to win the mayorship. I still don't discount.
I believe her. I simply remember her going out and saying, well, if I'm not your first choice, let me be your second choice.
Second choice, right.
So I think she played it very well.
I think she played it very well. But remember, there's also two other things here. She also had a few weeks ago, two of her top staffers quit on her, and there are rumors that her campaign doesn't have a lot of money at this point. And so there's lots of stuff swirling that are really making it difficult for her running for this second term.
Right. And I think you do have this enormous pressure with the Super Bowl.
Exactly.
I mean, this is a singular event.
Right.
And everybody will be looking at Minneapolis. And then you also have had this exodus from downtown Minneapolis of all these retailers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just tonight, in fact, the closing of the Barnes & Noble there, which is sitting opposite the empty Macy's.
That's right.
And it's been decimated.
That's right.
Really decimated, although there are apparently some plans. I guess Haskell's is going to be opening a wine bar, you know, but that seems all so small compared to the loss of these larger retailers, and you just kind of wonder what will happen. And obviously, we shall see. I mean, I don't think it's going to be as. Didn't it take several days to figure out who the winner was last time because there were so many candidates?
It did. There were 38 people last time. I think it took about 3 or 4 days.
It did.
They did change some of the rules about ballot access. And
they made it a little harder to enter. I think the entry fee was about $10.
It was $10. It was back then.
So something like that. I mean, crazy like that.
Yeah, I think anybody could have entered the race, and just about anybody did.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, David Schultz, thank you so much. And when is your sojourn to – what's your next sojourn out of the country?
My next sojourn, actually, next Saturday, I am leaving for Jerusalem for 5 days.
Wow.
And so I will not be around for next Saturday. But then after that, I'm around for quite a while. Then it'll be 2 weeks in July that I'll be teaching in Beijing.
Wow. That sounds very – it'll be interesting to hear your perspective from the Middle East as well.
Yeah.
All right, when you return. Well, listen – safe travels to Jerusalem, and can't wait to hear what you have to say afterwards in a couple of weeks.
Good. And I'll send you the comb-over picture of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. And I'll put it back up. And it is on my Twitter, at Esme Murphy. Thank you so much, sir.
Bye.
All right, folks. Thank you to David Schultz again. Thank you to Susan Blanche, the producer of this show, to Jonathan Lowe, and to Kevin Reed, our studio coordinators. Please tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. I'll be there live with Mike Augustinak with all the latest news, weather, and any developments in sports. Thank you so much.